The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
And a very good morning to you. It's just approaching 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 26th of May, 2023. And you're very welcome along to another edition of the 9 till noon show. And it just happens to be the last one of the week. Our Friday panel, I'll introduce them to you right now. We want you very much involved in the conversation as well with your views to 086 60 25 000, WhatsApps and texts to that number. From outside the Republic, of course, 00353 86 60 25 000. Give us a call on 0749125000 or email comments at highlandradio.com. and of course you can watch this show live across our social media. We're on YouTube Ireland to watch on your phone, laptop, tablet, your Fire Stick, your smart TV. And we're across Facebook as well. And you can watch us by clicking Watch Live on our website. So no excuses. Right, let's introduce our guests this morning. We have Michael Harrison, who is a cyber threat consultant. Good morning, Michael. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
It's great to have you with us. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Catherine Noon, lawyer and former Fine Gael senator. Catherine, good morning.
Morning, Greg. Nice to see you.
Great to have you back on the programme. And last and not least, John McAteer, editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune newspaper. Good morning, John.
Morning, Greg.
It's great to have all of you on board. Right. The government's facing fresh differences over a contentious Fine Gael proposal for a €1,000 budget tax cut. This really targeting, I suppose, you could describe them as the struggling working or the squeezed middle. Fianna Fáil sources are sceptical of claims over how many people would benefit from the plan. Controversy emerged this week following a newspaper article written by three Fine Gael ministers of state, which argued tax breaks worth €1,000 should be targeted at full-time workers on an average wage of €52,000. Now, I don't believe that to be an average wage here in Donegal, but anyway, the article was seen as unwelcome budget kite-flying by multiple sources within Fianna Fáil. Right, so all of you have followed politics for quite some time. I'll start with you, John McAteer. 6 months out from a budget, this would be somewhat unusual, and it seems that Fine Gael has taken its coalition partners by surprise in this move.
I suppose they have, in a way, because they didn't really expect that the Taoiseach was going to lead that whole charge by announcing €1,000 a year of a tax break for workers on over 50,000. And he keeps talking about the squeezed middle. He created that, and his party. Michael Noonan created that in 2013 when he raided the pension plots of the private sector. 770,000 of them had substantial money. And that money was needed to build roads, to keep hospitals open and all that in 2013 and 14 and 15. And sure, they went and raided it, and you got up in the morning to discover that they'd taken it, and it went on for 3 years. To pay that back now, which has to be paid back, is estimated to cost about €2,500 per each individual. Now, he'd be far better talking about that and why he hasn't paid it back, because it's one of the last remaining vestiges of the cuts during the Celtic Tiger that they didn't pay back. But of course, it's kite flying to the highest order. Fine Gael is winding that up. They're doing poorly in the opinion polls since Leo Varadkar took over last December. And no matter which way they seem to throw the dice, they have this obsession, of course, with Sinn Féin. Who hasn't an obsession with Sinn Féin these days? Even Sinn Féin themselves. But they've left the whole process of government with the partners, particularly with Fianna Fáil, in a complete spin. And you have Donal Creed, the former minister, at the parliamentary party meeting the other night, warning that they weren't going to take lessons from Fianna Fáil, the party that drove the country onto the rocks, and they're still on probation. It's all kind of nonsensical. It's a bit of handbagging, but it's
clever, though, isn't it? It is clever because
is it clever?
Well,
really?
It is from a PR perspective, for the reasons I'll outline. If it is delivered, it's Fine Gael that delivered it. B, if it's not delivered, it's Fianna Fáil and the Greens that did not deliver it. And as we approach an election, either they get the lift from this being given, or they get the separation and arguably a lift from Fianna Fáil. From Fianna Fáil denying the hard-working public this money. So, and to do it so far out, they've caught Fianna Fáil by surprise. From a public relations perspective of Fine Gael, it's great, isn't it? No?
But Fianna Fáil has handled it very, very badly by not being out there as well, because they had expected that. They had that form from Leo Varadkar, the day he became Taoiseach, back in 2018, was it? And the reality here is that there's going to be a big budget for everybody. It's going to be the same way last year. At this time last year, they were talking up paying €20 a week extra to pensioners just to meet the cost of living. That didn't happen, of course, at the height of the food inflation. They gave them €12, which was a miserly amount. And right down the line, they actually have got money to burn this year and indeed next year if we're going to have two budgets before the next general election in a year from the autumn.
Yeah, but the Fianna Fáil will want to be, they're holding the purse strings. They'll want to be seen to be steering steady. This could cost anything up to €3 billion for this one thing. And there's also some sort of disagreement as it relates to how many it might actually benefit. That's the front of the Irish Independent today. I'll come back to you on that. Interested in everyone's views, of course, not least Catherine Noon, lawyer and former Fine Gael senator. What's your take on this, Catherine?
Well, it's interesting. I think you're right. I think it was clever. The very fact that we're talking about it now and that the three particular Fine Gael ministers floated this. I mean, it's not new policy. The Taoiseach has floated this type of policy a lot. And he has consistently spoken about those who get up early in the morning. And, you know, whether you like that kind of rhetoric or not, there is a reality that a lot of my contemporaries and people that I know well, you know, who are paying a lot for a lot of things, feel squeezed. That's not a fiction. That's reality. So it's a fair idea, in my opinion, to suggest a policy that would help with that for mm-hmm. people around the country and all you know, in all areas of the country. It is a real thing. So, you know, and as regards, you know, the work that was done by Michael Noonan, I mean, I was a senator at the time. That was a very difficult period. That was post a crash. A lot of very difficult decisions were made. You know, the very fact that we're talking about the country being awash with money and having a surplus, that's also, we have problems.
Yeah, John, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, you know, no, but we have problems in
of course you can.
All right, that's my fault, Catherine. Go ahead. That's my fault.
I didn't interrupt anyone.
But that was my fault. Go ahead. Yeah.
And you lose your flow of thought when that happens, if you don't mind. But the reality is that there are difficulties in the country. We have a housing situation that is very, very challenging that emanates from that period that was discussed. So, you know, these type of measures to help people, and the fact that the country is awash with money leaves us in a position, as the previous speaker said, where we can actually give money or, you know, implement policy changes that might help. You know, I mean, there's a certain level of fatigue when a party has been in government as long as Fine Gael have, you know, and, you know, anything that goes wrong, that they will obviously get blamed for. And anything that's right isn't discussed because we have a way in this country of not acknowledging any of the positives. You know, so for those who get up early in the morning, for those who work hard, for those who feel like they're paying a lot and getting very little assistance, I think it would be a really good idea. And I mean, whatever tussle goes on politically between Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, that's politics. They're just doing their
so
job.
So in relation to the country being awash with money, as we're told, and I'm, of course, very conscious that there's many people listening to this programme that seemed completely irrelevant to, and hopefully the budget in some way might address that. But just to your point in terms of not, it is not really actually framed as a positive thing, is it? It's almost seen as a negative to have this surplus, and the talk tends to be about, oh, but it's just a happenstance and it's not permanent and it's going to run out, and if we don't do it correctly and we should be writing down national. It is not actually framed, from what I see or read, as you say, Catherine, in fairness, as a positive, and there doesn't seem to be any credit given to any individual or collective for actually producing it.
We're not wired that way as a people. You know, we complain about what's wrong and we don't tend to vote, you know, and the papers don't tend to focus on the things that are going well. You know, that's human nature in a way. But the reality is, and it is frustrating, by the way, to hear that there's a surplus and we're still short of housing and, you know, that we can't get our act together in health in the way that we should. And, you know, that we have people who are homeless in the country and that, you know, we have a lot of environmental or outside factors like the war in Ukraine post-Brexit, post-COVID. It has been a difficult few years.
But then this all then, does it not, Catherine, come down to government and what they do and how they communicate? And when I say government, I'm on about any government, not necessarily the current government, because if people felt that services for mental health services and hospitals were improving, or that there were fewer people in poverty, or there was more money in the pocket, or, you know, then they might be able to actually relate to the positive news of a surplus. But 100%. I think the problem is that people hear this number and they talk about us being wealthy, but they don't feel it. And I think that actually causes a greater disconnect and divide. So
total frustration, you know, because you hear of there being a surplus. And, you know, in this area where I live, I'm in Fawn near Buncrana, you know, there's a huge shortage of housing for everybody, you know, notwithstanding, you know, the people who are trying to help who've come from the Ukraine. And, you know, that is very frustrating for people. So there's no point, as you say, it doesn't feel tangible. That benefit doesn't feel tangible. But I would hope that the budget would try and address a lot of that when we have the room to. And it is prudent management of the economy to, you know, when there is a surplus, to make sure you keep some for a rainy day, which is what Fine Gael have consistently done, which isn't acknowledged much either. And, you know, notwithstanding all of the difficulties we have, at least we are in a position with a surplus to make some decisions that can make a difference.
Yeah, I just feel that, and I know nothing other than I sit here a couple of hours every day, I just feel that a party or a government would get more of a bounce if services and general life improved rather than an extra €20 per week in the wage packet, which will, you know yourself, that will be framed as, sure, that's not even really matching inflation. So you know what I mean?
That's where we're going to end up. You know, you're quite right. There are more fundamental issues that need to be addressed than handing out a few quid in the budget. But the budget does take care of the spend on everything.
Yeah, no, I get that. But you know, people have to feel it for the benefit of the decision makers, sure. I think. Michael, Michael Harrison, what's your view on it? I mean, we're talking about a budget in earnest 6 months out, really. You know, it's crazy. You've never seen it before.
Well, it's kind of, it's as an ordinary, as a just an ordinary person, I just think, you know, the discussion paper, the way it was released, I just feel quite cynical about it, about the whole thing, you know, about why it was done, you know, 6 months out, generating discussions, generating distraction from so many other problems that we have at the moment, particularly in this county. Even just picking one thing that just came to my head, I heard another discussion on it this morning, it was about child mental health services. Like, there's no investment happening in that whatsoever. There's investment in housing. Like, we have so many other problems in this, you know, in this country at the moment, in this county at the moment, and all of a sudden you have this discussion paper which is released, which is really and truly very, very old-fashioned politics, going back to the times when Charlie Hawley was on, when these distractions, to distract us from thinking about the real issues that are happening. And I honestly think that people will see through this, and that's why they are treating it with the cynicism that it deserves.
Yeah, because the public consume information and dissect it and process it differently now. Yet we still have it seems in politics and the media, they're doing it still in a way in which I don't really think the general population now consume or disseminate information. I think people are far more critical in their thinking and can see sort of maybe the distraction stuff.
Yeah, they can. And I honestly think that the Fine Gael have misjudged this, because, you know, the people will see through. They will see through this. From reading it, I don't think it's even been costed properly. This is a discussion paper, and if you have other political parties are going to sit down there, they're going to dissect this and see, can this actually be delivered? And you know, and this is where you have a party there that is under severe pressure in the polls, that is going to take a beating at the next election. You know, they have already lost a number of TDs, very, very eminent people who are not running at the next election. They're having trouble getting people to go forward. And all of a sudden you have this, as far as I'm concerned, as an ordinary person, this is just an absolute distraction. You know, that's all it is. Yeah. I don't believe it. You know, I just see right through it. I give no credibility whatsoever.
And before we move on, just a quick other point to John first and then Catherine. This is slightly different, John, and as I say, Catherine can respond to this herself too, in that, of course, you know, this has been stated by Leo Varadkar in the past, and it's probably common knowledge-y type Fine Gael policy, but it was the manner in which it was done, three junior ministers writing in a national newspaper, all kind of on the same sheet, and then the senior members of the party not distancing themselves from it. So, it's not really... this just carries a little bit more weight than a politician stating what they might want to do.
Effectively, this is the PR machine run amok, actually. We're snowed under in the media with PR releases every day from government departments. You ask the most basic of questions about something here in Donegal, and you get hook, line and sinker, the whole government policy on something that you never asked about at all. They have made it a profession, actually, to answer the questions that you never asked or you would never even intend asking. This is where the cynicism amongst the public comes out about politics. There'll be Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil in leadership. People have no credibility about them anymore. And that's quite understandable. I mean, you go up to A&E at Letterkenny General or any other one in the country, there's nothing wrong with the health system that structure money wouldn't fix. Two decent wards in Letterkenny Hospital with 50 extra beds, and it would encourage consultants to come in there and stay there if you have the capacity. Consultants don't come in to sit around all day. We're talking about this for over 30 years, and all that has happened is it has gone downhill and gotten worse. The same is to be said of the whole housing situation. There's more and more young people leaving. Even in my own parish here, there's 32 people have left since Christmas time. Most of them couples. They can't afford a house. They will never be able to build a house. They will never get a mortgage. So these are the issues that are not being confronted. People are being priced out of having a house out in rural Ireland. I see it every day of the week. I'm hearing from people who are in that situation. And that's the God's honest truth on the matter. The money is there. It's how it's going to be managed. Is it going to be mismanaged for the sake of winning an election like elections have been won down the years? As you say, going back to Charlie Haughey and to Charlie McCreevy, back in those days when we have it, we're going to spend it. But, you know, on top of all that, the whole infrastructure of the country is literally falling apart between our roads. Just driving our roads in Donegal, they're absolutely appalling.
Is it that bad, John?
It's worse even.
All right. Catherine, do you think people are in for a shock if Sinn Féin pull it off at the next election and then, you know, the reality dawns that, you know, there is a permanent government in situ, that things take an awful long time to adjust, that... when you start all of a sudden thinking you can tax the rich, that, you know, certain threats of pulling out of the country or whatever, or moving operations elsewhere begin to be made. Now, I'm not saying that will all transpire, but it possibly could. But do you think people are in for a little bit of a shock when they realise that you can sort of change the faces and the policy a little bit, but the problems are so deep-rooted that it might take many election cycles for to see real positive change?
It's a very fair question, and one that I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about. I think Sinn Féin are a very strategic, organised party. They've played the long game. I mean, you have to take your hat off to them in so many ways. What I would think is that, in my experience in politics and outside of politics, trying to get things done, it's very rarely former colleagues who I might chat to about things, you know, just trying to get good stuff done in different areas. It's very rarely a situation where I could fairly say that it's them that's blocking something happening, you know. And, you know, I'm involved with a project where I've been dealing with one department, and the source of frustration, I can't even express it to you. I know that this particular politician is interested in this happening, you know, but it's being blocked, you know, for various reasons. And those nuances are missed, you know. And a part of me would just love Sinn Féin to get in and, you know, for them to be, I don't know how they'll cope with being actually governing the country, because They are an obstructionist type of party in many ways, in that they're used to being in opposition, you know. So it would be very interesting to see how they would manage. But going back to a point that Michael made about, you know, some of my former colleagues who I would know well leaving politics, some of them are younger, some of them are near retirement age. Politics is a very difficult job now. You can say what you like about the money that people earn and it's a good wage, but the work that goes into it, the level of negativity that it brings to your life, I don't expect any sympathy or whatever, acknowledgement even of that, but it is a reality. And it is not an easy career. And for somebody like me, who's a lawyer by profession, to go in and be a politician, it makes no financial sense. So, you know, people usually go into politics because they've got the greater good at heart or because they feel that they can make a difference. And the way that things have evolved throughout the world, not just in Ireland.
But just in relation to that, though, is it
a politician is just like, you know, you're scum of the earth.
Yeah, but certain jobs and professions are heavily overrepresented in the Dáil, right? Okay. Yeah, well, they are. Exactly. So is that a coincidence, or are they all in there for the better good, but happen to be in positions of decision making power that might benefit the areas in which they work and have interests?
I've chatted to you about this before. I mean, like, I'm, as I said, a lawyer by profession. I rarely spoke about legal issues. I nearly always spoke about female health issues, obesity, you know, different issues like around homelessness. You know, I was on the children's committee. Like, certain careers, certain backgrounds in your education lend you to politics more readily. It doesn't mean that you don't go in there and just think if you're a farmer, you're only going to speak about farmers.
No, of course not.
But better understanding.
Yeah, but that doesn't. But even if having that impression doesn't necessarily reflect poorly on you or question your motivation either. I'm talking about it as a collective.
No, and I know you're not. I completely understand your question. Maybe I'm not addressing it as well as you might like. But, you know, the point that I was making is slightly separate. And Michael was making the point about people leaving Fine Gael, and they're leaving politics. Mm. They're not necessarily leaving Fine Gael. I would see those as actually very bright, they're making a decision for themselves and their families that makes sense. Being a politician in Ireland has become extremely difficult for all parties, and it's not just Fine Gael. And I just say that as somebody who has the objectivity of having been in the career, who can look back and say, God, what was that self-harm?
Well, listen, even on the programme yesterday, we had a long chat with Senator Eileen Flynn, who is not a member of a party, who's an independent, and just outlining the choices that have to be made between her job, and also too, that if she raises issues on, say, for instance, affecting the traveller community, it actually, she becomes a lightning rod for criticism,
100%.
As opposed
and
to
as
being
a woman,
lauded for it.
And as a woman, sorry to cut across you, Greg,
no problem.
As a woman, it's a level way worse, you know. And, you know, God forbid a woman would suggest something that, you know, isn't a popular thing to say. I mean, when you try to articulate this, you sound like some sort of crazy feminist, but it's a reality. And the abuse is just intense but especially for women.
I think to the majority of population, you wouldn't sound like that. Michael, so having listened to Catherine, are there any more sympathy for politicians? I mean,
I certainly would.
Like, Catherine's not looking for sympathy, of course.
No, I'm not, Michael. And I take your point as well, you know.
Okay. I certainly would have sympathy for people that put themselves forward for election and to represent their constituents. And you have to remember, in this country, like this country is, we're 100 years down the road, we're a democracy, and we have a very, very decent number of people representing us in Dáil Éireann and on councils right across the country. Honourable, decent people. And this country's only 100 years old. We should be extremely proud of what we've achieved as a nation. You know, to do this within 100 years, to have decent, honourable politicians. And I can totally understand why anybody would want to leave politics, because I certainly wouldn't be able for.
Well, just on that point, if you don't mind, Michael, I think almost it's any position of power or authority, because there's an awful lot of people listening to this program today. If the young person come up to them and said, "I want to be a member of the Guards," they would say, "Hold on a second, find something else to do," because, you know. And we're going to talk about that a little later on in the programme. It kind of feels like it's becoming a thankless task, and that the Guards are fair game for criticism. Like, it's not that long ago since we had sort of public sentiment reports to the Gardaí that, you know, held them up on the pedestal and corners of the community and lots of respect and all that there. I can't wait to see the next one because we seem to be in a very different environment. And just for context, Catherine, I'm not sure if you're aware or not, that Michael's a former Garda, of course, as well. So, you know, it's any position of sort of authority or that I wouldn't be too keen personally.
It's been a public servant at the moment. It's the level of scrutiny that people, and it's the level of expectations of people, you know, the people expect of their public servants, whether it be a member of the Garda Síochána, whether it be the nurse in A&E, whether it be the doctor, it doesn't matter. It's right across the public service. There's a high expectation of people, and you know, people, and there's this level of entitlement, and it just mightn't be able to be delivered. The policies that they have might be totally inadequate, but it is very, very difficult. And with the Garda, members of the Garda Síochána, like, there's very, very few employment positions out there where if you make a mistake, you can face criminal prosecution, you can face criminal sanction. And that is what is making anybody that wants to join the Garda Síochána, they're thinking, they're looking, you know, do I really want to put myself forward into a position like that? It's very, very difficult, and it is the way society has evolved in general, and I really don't know how it can be addressed.
Yeah, I think we're going through a stage. How long that lasts or if it's a permanent change, who is to say? We're in the company of Michael Harrison, cyber threat consultant, who you've just heard from, John McAteer, the editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune newspaper and lawyer and former Fine Gael senator, Catherine Noon. Just a quick one, because it got quite a bit of interest from our listeners. The GEA have reiterated to units their rules around Go Games, the policy that stipulates no competition for children under 12 level and below. Go Games encourages inclusivity through no score keeping, rolling subs, no cups, no medals, but blitzes are regularly organised with a competitive element, which the GEA want to see eliminated. So the question is, should under 12s be allowed to play competitive GEA games? And it was interesting talking to a young person on the show yesterday, 14 years of age, who is of the belief, or was of the belief, that it's really important to sort of understand winning and losing from an early age. I'll stay with you on this one, if that's all right, Michael Harrison. As I say, we'll not hang around too long, but what do you think?
It is a delicate balance to achieve. And, you know, I honestly believe what the GA are looking to do here is they're looking to keep young people involved in sport as long as possible. And the one thing that I do know about why children lose interest in sport is because they probably don't get the opportunity to play the sport. And this is, you know, if it becomes competitive at under 12, and you have to remember that these are children we're talking about. I know the people standing on the sideline are parents, and they might be absolutely passionate about it, but the people on the pitch are children. And it's about keeping the enthusiasm for the sport, for the game, with them as long as possible. Because once they get older, the interest in it falls away, and that's where you get massive drop-off in children in Ireland playing sports. But again, with the Garda's under 14 competitions, I believe it is time at this stage then to introduce the competitive issue to make them aware that the difference and the importance of winning and and losing and winning a game, that it is important. But with the Garda's under 12s, I do agree with that policy. I think it is important.
Let me put it to you. So, I mean, obviously then it is worth it because it might keep more people, more young people interested in participating in sport. But do we not lose then perhaps an opportunity to teach people through sport that sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, that sometimes you have to work harder to be more successful. Sometimes you have to make decisions that something might not necessarily be for you, and to choose something else. You know, are we not losing? And as well as that, too, you know, if you hear of all the top sports people, they're competing from a very young age.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing, Greg. When I talk to parents about cybersecurity, and they're talking to me about the children know more about this device than I do. They are so they are completely switched on about this device. They are completely switched on about. But where we lose, where we forget, we're talking about children. Mm. You know, we're not talking about they don't have the mental capacity to understand the difference between winning and losing. What we're trying to teach them is how to enjoy the game. how, you know, how much fun playing a sport can be involved in, and the level of drop off of particularly. And I have attended a county seminar, not in Donegal, where I heard this discussed. The level of drop off of young ladies, you know, once they reach the age of 14 in participating in football is massive, and they don't get involved with sport again after that. And I honestly think that if you encourage this love of the sport in them and keep it with them as long as possible, you're going to keep them in that sport. Yeah. It'll be soccer, whether it be Gaelic,
or so it could be all of it. I think a lot of the problems with girls at that age, particularly if they're particularly talented, because arguably it might be a smaller pool, that they're being asked to play Gaelic, they're being asked to play rugby, they're being asked to play basketball, and rather than to choose one, some of them are actually opting to leave it altogether because there's so much demands on them. So I would like to see us address that if we're actually going to really worry about younger people. John McAteer, do you have a view on this?
Of course I do. I've been covering football all my life and writing about it. I can't see or understand how you curb the enthusiasm of children of 6 and 7 and 8 not to be competitive, because the human brain becomes very interested and very competitive at a very, very early age. And if you're going to say to them, look, you can't compete until you're 12, is there some way that you sort of switch that off? And that the day that they're 12 years of age, you automatically switch it on and expect them to perform. I mean, if they can't get interested, and I don't know how you control this, I agree with a lot of what Michael is saying there. There's a very high expectation of all parents that their Johnny or Mary Kate is going to be the next one targeted by the Man United or the Man City manager to come over and play for them. It's not like that. But parents do add to the higher expectations of children. It's a good thing, but it needs to be controlled a little bit more. But keeping children almost inactive from competition, it's not in their natural instinct to do that. And I think the GAA is getting that wrong. But then again, if parents can't manage it and if they can't control it, then there are issues there. I mean, what's to stop those children going and playing other sports? I mean, did you ever hear of any country that has children banned from being competitive? Under 12 years of age.
See, I recently watched a game for under 12s, and it was a game of Gaelic football, and it was lovely. They were running up and down and kicking points and scoring goals, but no score was kept whatsoever. And then when it was almost like one team was getting the upper hand, even though they were from different parishes, players were switched between it. And then the other team was running up and down and scoring points and goals and nothing. Nothing. There was no score kept. I'll put this to you, Catherine. I kind of struggled to see what the function of it was. It was a training exercise, or maybe improving on the skills. I wasn't really quite sure what was going on. If that makes sense, and I don't mean that harshly, but I didn't know. Well, what was happening? You're muted there. Sorry, Catherine.
Apologies. I agree with both John and Michael on this and most of what they both said. And it really, it kind of is about balance. I mean, the fact that the GAA have put this policy in place means that there is an issue, I would think. I don't have children myself, so I wouldn't be as close to it as maybe some other people. But just from, I'd be a long-suffering Mayo supporter and a long-time GAA fan as well, you know. But what happens is a lot of the time is that the best are nurtured and the rest are neglected. And, you know, that happens when, and I totally take the points that both John and Michael have said, and I'd agree with them. It's hard to know what's best because coaches and parents, you know, as John was saying, a lot of the time, they're the ones really pushing for the child. And I mean, the Irish dancing, I mean, do you remember the controversy around that? And, you know, there was all sorts of crazy shenanigans going on. And it just came down to these parents, I think, maybe living their youths again or something. You know, people need to get a hold of themselves. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, it has to be fun for children. I agree with John's comments in particular about competitiveness. So it's hard to know how to harness that, but while still letting them have fun and enjoy it. And, you know, it's not on really that children would be training in the way that adults do. And that search for talent identification and cultivation earlier and earlier and earlier, you know, that's a thing. So I would think that's why the GAA have done this. But, you know, it's a hard, it's, I think we've established between the lot of us that's a hard one to know exactly how to address it.
But the person most firm in their views, I think, on this is Michael. And Michael, you know, so these rules are there really, are they? Because fundamentally, we as adults can't control ourselves. Coaches can't sort of say, right, OK, I'm going to be give equal attention, not just to the superstars of the future. Or moms and dads and guardians on the sidelines can't keep their mouths shut.
You know, as I said, it's people forgetting that the young people are running up and down the pitch are children. And that is, if we remember that, then it'll be okay. And I think the GAA are right to experiment with this, see how it goes, because there is a problem nationally. I've heard it discussed where young people are dropping off, and they are dropping off, and the participation, particularly in the teenage years, becomes less and less. And it's trying to harness that, try to keep it. And it is a worthwhile experiment to see how it works out. And it is just, and children, it's about, they can enjoy the game. Like, you know, if children are out there kicking the ball, like, who knows that they're not enjoying themselves? As parents, we mightn't enjoy watching it because we don't know who's winning or who's losing it.
Oh, what's happening?
It is our competitive streak that is there, that we want to be standing on the sidelines screaming and making runs for referees and whatever, you know, about decisions that are made.
Oh, I've seen that too.
Remembering that they're children.
I've seen that too at I think it might have been under 14s. The abuse the referee got was just unbelievable.
Remember the Dumbelievables where one of them was like, and you won't know what, get out there, insult their mother, insult their aunt, and you won't know what the hell hit you next year when you're playing under 14.
Okay.
It's a bit like that.
I mean, are you going to allow these children to watch the All-Ireland series, which is highly competitive? Or where do you draw?
But you could watch.
Here?
But they could watch the All Ireland series, right? And and emulate their heroes on the pitch without the fear of losing.
No.
I'm gonna have to take.
You can't have children of 10 or 11 years of age sitting back there. We can't be competitive. They'll go off somewhere else and be competitive at something else.
That is a thing.
Could you blame them?
Mm. And but as Michael says, it's an experiment and we have to try something. Okay, back with more from our guests. Go ahead, John. Is it not
a handy way out for the GAA to push the responsibility onto the parents entirely?
Right, on that bombshell, we'll take a break. Kind of was thinking just during the break there on our last conversation that, you know, the young ones are out playing the GAA and there's no winners, no losers. And then they go home and start playing FIFA on the PlayStation and put the controller through the TV screen. when they don't get a win. Listening to you there about underage players, I witnessed it for years that the kids with no skills were left on the sideline while ones who never showed up for training got on. Don't get me wrong, coaches do a great job, but they sometimes ignore the kids with less skills. It's all about the wins. Another, we learn by our mistakes. It fosters a motivation to grow, develop and improve. In Irish dancing, not everyone gets a medal. I've seen children slowly develop to become winners and it means so much more to them. Or is it their parents anyway? People who do win have to work hard to keep winning and they do lose at times, but that makes winning more of an achievement. Another, it's the mentality of the parent and some coaches that needs to change. Education is the key. And last, just for now on this topic, I blame everyone is a winner culture. It's a huge factor in rising mental health issues. Development of coping skills at an early age and building resilience is paramount in child and adolescent development. Inclusion is key, but it's all about balance. But I would say there's benefits too to being involved in sport in the long term and being around your friends and participating in someone's positive mental health as well. Just a quick question, if you wish here. A listener was registering their child for an under-6s sports class and was shocked when it came to selecting the child's gender. The options were male, female, non-binary, other, and prefer not to say. They say this is completely unacceptable for children of this age. What's your view? Do you share their concerns or do you welcome the more inclusive language? Catherine, as I say, we didn't. This has only just come in, so it's off the top of the head, but go ahead.
It's a difficult one. It really is. And it's very contentious. And for anyone on Twitter, you know, it's a huge issue. I mean, there's a fine line between encouraging a child to potentially change gender and actually being open to them wanting to at a certain age. Like, I had a cousin when we were younger who was definitely a bit of a tomboy, short hair, you know, tractors, you know, she married a man, you know, she wasn't a boy, you know. It's a difficult area to talk about because it's hard to know what is the best to do in those type of
circumstances. Not talking about that person, right? But if you don't mind, not talking about that person, but talking about another person who would be similar. Yeah. In this day and age, might they find adults sort of going, you know, do you feel like a boy? Do you? And I know it's a difficult conversation, like but is that the potential that maybe now that person wouldn't be allowed to fully go through whatever things they were in life and then find their path themselves?
That's what I'm saying. There's a fine line between encouraging it and being receptive if there is an issue, you know, and I certainly wouldn't identify. I mean, the person I'm talking about definitely.
I get that.
Lady or anything. So sorry if I, you know, I didn't intend to potentially identify anyone, but, and it's in a very harmless way that I say that, you know, but it is, it's a fine line. It's a really fine line, and it's very difficult for parents and teachers to navigate that stuff. And there's a fine line becoming, you know, between becoming totally open, being encouraging. There are kind of three layers of it, you know, that you're totally open, that we have an open society where we're accepting of people regardless of their choices, sexually and otherwise, or actually encouraging children who would otherwise, you know, be the gender that they were born. And, you know, it's a tricky one, Greg.
Yeah, because...
it's not a comfortable one to talk about.
No, it isn't. And we're trying to be really sensitive. And of course, I'm not going to get into the deep parts of it that can be so divisive. But I just think with children nowadays, you know, I saw a study out of America and it was not left or right or in the middle or whatever, but it literally just was asking children how they identified. And I can't remember the exact percentage, but I won't use it. But it was up close towards half identified in either LGBTQ I, right? And I don't necessarily, I just think that maybe because you're a child and you're developing, that might be more, you might find yourself saying, yeah, I feel I'm in that space more than you might. And of course, you know, we don't talk about necessarily defined genders anymore. So the children don't have the guidance, and that seems to be right. Well, that's a place that I've maybe fit in more. And John, what is your views? Now, this is adults registering their children. This is not under sixes that are accessing these choices. So let's be clear about that. But for under sixes, the options were male, female, non-binary, other, or prefer not say. So as I say, the children aren't exposed to that, but it is it's an interesting drop-down menu for parents, I think, when they're registering a four-year-old for a sports class.
Oh, absolutely. And what Catherine says there is 100% right. It's going to be a very, very challenging one to deal with. It also begs the question, at what age should you have to start making decisions around that? I would know of parents, again, like Catherine, I know of a parent who decided for the child what their gender was going to be and sending to school in a different garb. And, I mean, after a couple of years, that all changed. At that age, you know, six, is that the right age to start making those kind of decisions, or is it far too young? I believe it's far, far too young. No more than all sorts of issues of that kind that you're confronted with. You will only be wise after the event. And I mean, in 10 years' time, you may be well be told that we've handled this very badly. We don't probably have the right guidance educationally or psychologically on
this. Do you
this.
Think as adults we need to actually, if we all really care about children, which we really do, and we want to have a proper conversation about that, there's a few things we might have to strip out. Drag queens, for example. The word grooming. Religion. Do you know what I mean? Stuff that our adults are arguing about on Twitter that all gets lumped in and we actually can't have a conversation. We've been dragged into a space where, and Catherine quite rightly points it out, it's very difficult to have a conversation. You could be cancelled or a clip could be taken and you could be described as this, that or the other, or even using the phrase tomboy. Do you know what I'm on about? Like, so if we really care about kids, we have to figure out how to talk about this without taking each other's heads off.
We're living in a country where it seems the obvious thing to do is take sides one way or the other without sort of a middle ground that could be either or. I'm not too sure where we fit on that. I think we lack the skills educationally. We lack the skills professionally. The teaching and the training is not there to advise parents. I mean, to me, from having worked in the health system for 21 years, six is a very young age to be asking anybody to decide what the sexuality of their child might turn out to be. And it's something that probably needs a lot more discussion around it. We're trying to discuss it here this morning in our own simple way, yet we don't have an issue about discussing it. But it needs to become much, much more open. There would need to be an agenda set there from a medical point of view to inform parents on that, and from a psychological point of view, which is probably more important at that age of their of their very formative years.
It is actually quite interesting that I don't think a government has assembled like they did with COVID, for an example, on such an important issue affecting people, assembled like a proper group of medics and psychologists and what have you to assist parents and caregivers in this, because I think you make a really good point there. Michael, can I come to you? What's your, as I say, and I want to just reiterate, this is not children that have to make this choice. This is a parent being asked to make this selection, but it maybe talks to the atmosphere out there.
Yeah, I think there's I think the other two speakers, you know, they have addressed most of the points there that I would mention. There is a fear, definitely fear out there about discussing this, because there's the fear, as you say, about this, you know, the cancel culture that exists at the moment, that's saying the wrong things about this. And I think that's why a lot of groups are including these other types of sexuality in the drop-down menus. But asking a parent of a six-year-old that question, I really would ask that organisation you know, what national guidance have they got to ask a parent of a six-year-old that question? Have they, you know, is this something that they are doing just to keep the, you know, just to keep the cancel culture people happy by including all these things? Or is it a legitimate question that you can ask of a six-year-old? What research have they used, you know, to do this? But, you know, what research exists? And again, I completely agree with you. It is time that the government, that they introduce a national policy on this to decide how we're going to deal with this question, because it is causing problems, you know, for different sections of our communities, that these questions are being asked. And it's something that the government are saying, well, we'll sit in our hands and we'll do nothing. It's something that the nettle is going to have to be grasped.
Yeah, because it is driving actually hate to groups of individuals that we thought we'd overcome in the past. Catherine, you wanted to come in there, please.
I just thought, yeah, and I agree with, but we're very agreeable with one another this morning. But, the fundamental sex education program in schools, I came across this during the Eighth Amendment stuff. You know, we tend to deal with the output rather than the actual issues a lot of the time. And, you know, really our sex education program in schools isn't to standard. And parents need to be assisted, I think, in many cases with, as both John and Michael have said, with, you know, guidelines, or, you know, what to do in these circumstances, or what to not do, you know. And, you know, I think education is key. And I have always found our approach to sex education and anything to do with gender, you know, there's a big difference between gender and sexuality. And, you know, a lot of people don't even fully understand that. So, you know, I think we really need to grow up on this stuff as a country and, you know, get educated on it properly. And when you try to do that, you get a whole load of kickback amongst all of the different parties that John and Michael have talked about, you know, that we shouldn't be teaching children certain things, you know. And
yeah, but I think parents need to actually know what is being taught, though. Do you know what I mean? Because a lot of it's stick figure stuff, and it's about children knowing if anything inappropriate's happening to them. But there's an awful lot of stuff that out there that's not there, and then there's stuff that is there that's not being talked about. And it's just, oh, people, if they have information and knowledge, they can make formed decisions rather than relying on the opinion of someone that they just tend to follow. I wish we had more time, Catherine. We don't. Thank you so very much indeed, Catherine Noon. It's great to have you on the show as always. Have a lovely weekend, will you?
Thank you.
And enjoy the beautiful Farn weather. As you know, it's like that all
yeah,
year round. Take care of yourself. Michael, thank you very much indeed. Great to have you on the programme. I really appreciate you accepting our invite. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Greg. Take care.
Bye-bye. And John McAteer, as always, great to hear your views. Let's not leave it so long. Thank you very much indeed, John.
Thank you, Greg.
Take care of yourself. Okay, thank you.